as a wannabe marketer, it's genius. It captures people's attention. I think it's awesome.
So I've spent the last year and a half like really looking at all these other businesses, not just in franchising, but a variety of industries, to find people who have cracked the code with hourly workers. There comes a point where the best thing you can do for yourself, your business, your customers, the team, and for that team member is to promote them to customer, is to let them go. The average person in a management position goes 10 years managing people before they ever get any formal management training. And so you'd think when a franchise says, we're gonna teach you everything you need to know to run a successful business. Well, there's one thing they don't, and that is,
I don't like to use the word employees. I just like to use the word team.
We're gonna teach you how to be an excellent collaborator and part of a team. And we're gonna show you what culture is and how you can enhance it. I believe that customers and employees have both hard needs and soft needs. My main idea was, you get thrown a lemon, eat the lemon. Sort of lean into it and try to find the benefits from that rather than just trying to flip it.
Do you wanna build a top performing team in your business? Now, unless you want to become a slave to your business, one of the skills you'll need to get good at is hiring and leading your team, aka your employees. Now, the challenge is that what it takes to hire and lead salaried employees is very different to what it takes to hire and lead hourly employees. There's actually a massive difference. And the average small business, and especially franchises, are building their business with most, if not all, hourly employees. So in this episode, I speak with Scott Greenberg, who has trained thousands of franchise owners at this point. And Scott's become a good friend of mine over the last 3 years, and he's just a quality guy that knows his stuff. Now, Scott's the author of The Wealthy Franchisee, Game-Changing Steps to Becoming a Thriving Franchise Superstar. And he just wrote a book called Stop the Shift Show, Turning Your Struggling Hourly Workers into a Top Performing Team. I think that title is brilliant. So we dove into creating a culture in your business. How do you create the right culture? Why is it important? And how do you do it? We talk about how to know when to fire employees versus actually coaching them up to become a key part of your team. But most importantly, we dove into specific tactics and how to be a great leader so that you can build a team that performs at a high level. This will allow you to have more peace of mind and just a more profitable business. Now, if you want to buy a franchise in the next 12 months, you should check out my free franchise masterclass at franchiseempire.com. And if you want to work with me and my team on finding or buying a franchise or resale business, then you can go to franchiseempire.com/check territory, and you can schedule a free call to see what's available in your area. The links are in the descriptions below. With that said, sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Franchise Empire Show. They say Rome wasn't built in a day, and building your empire doesn't happen overnight. My name is Tarek Johnson, and owning franchises is what helped me go from employee to employer and start building my empire for my family. So this podcast is for you, the empire builders. For those of you who want to build something that stands the test of time, this is for those of you who are crazy enough to believe that you can make the dream in your head come to life. This podcast is all about bringing you real people who are building real empires so you can get inside their mind and heart and get proven strategies and actionable insights that will catapult you to build, grow, and scale your empire. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Franchise Empire Show. I'm here with the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Scott Greenberg. Thanks for joining again, Scott.
Sure. I'm not sure if I'm a legend or a man, but definitely a myth. So I appreciate you having me back.
Yes, sir. I'll make sure to have included the myth part in the intro.
Okay.
So you wrote the book, The Wealthy Franchisee, which I think in many ways was quite innovative, because there was really, I think, no one really speaking to and making content specifically for franchisees. And geez, you've spoken at must have been dozens and dozens of franchise conferences at franchisors now, and to probably hundreds, if not thousands, of franchisees at this point. So I'm curious. I mean, you wrote this new book to Stop the Shift Show, which is a genius title, by the way. I love that title. That's so good.
I appreciate you saying that because my wife and two of her friends didn't think so. So every time I get positive feedback, it's a little bit of satisfaction. So thank you.
As a wannabe marketer, it's genius. It captures people's attention. I think it's awesome. But I'm curious.
Well, I think it also it really addresses the topic and the problem, right? It's like if you run a business with hourly workers, there's a decent chance that sometimes there's problems, and it's kind of an accurate term to describe what it can feel like sometimes. It certainly was for me.
Yeah, 100%. We were both in food businesses, I guess. Would you consider edible arrangements as a, is it considered a QSR? What is that considered?
Well, the health department certainly considered it a food service. So yes, I mean, we had those surprise inspections. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's a QSR in my opinion. It's not really a restaurant, but it's definitely food service, right? And so you're sort of dealing with all the things that are there. The level of service, it's not like, you have a drive-through. It's not like you have table service, but there's still a high level customer service. But food is there and everything that you'd associate with that kind of business is part of that as well.
Yeah. So food is known to have all sorts of fun challenges with employees. But what are you seeing and hearing from franchisees out there as some of the things and challenges that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis in their business?
Sure. Well, this is now my second book, and my goal with books is to identify a problem and try to provide solutions. And so with The Wealthy Franchisee, there was a handful of other books out there for franchisees, but I didn't see much about the human side of it, right? But I hear franchisees, getting in their own way, the sometimes tension between franchising and franchisor. And so all those human dynamics in the franchise world, I found very interesting, very problematic. And so I wanted to address that with this book. So that gave me a lot of exposure to other people in the franchise world. And I interviewed all these great people and some struggling people. And they come and talk to me after conferences where I speak. And of everything I discussed in that first book, the thing that got the most follow-up questions and the most interesting and sometimes, desperate conversations was franchisees' relationships with employees, and specifically their hourly employees, that they really struggle with them. Especially as, new generations enter the workforce, people talk about kids these days and no one wants to work. And then the pandemic happened and then everyone let their employees go and then invited them back, but then they couldn't find employees. It's an area where people really struggle how to find them, how to retain them, how to, boost their performance. And so seeing that there was such a challenge there, I wanted to tackle that. And certainly I had to tackle it when I owned my businesses. So I've spent the last year and a half really looking at all these other businesses, not just in franchising, but a variety of industries to find people who have cracked the code with hourly workers. And so that's what I wanted to focus on in this book. And so I'm super excited to get it out there.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I'm excited to have the conversation because I remember running multiple, QSR franchises, one on the opposite side of the country and, navigating sometimes the tensions between my manager and some of the other employees and just the different things that would happen and just running a business in California, which, has quite a few more regulations than most states when it comes to operating a business.
I've heard folks at IFA call it the People's Republic of California.
Sounds fitting.
I guess I try not to take offense, but
yeah, because you're in LA, right?
I'm in LA. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you know what the deal is.
I know what the deal is.
Yeah. So here's what's fascinating to me, and I had to learn this a little bit hard dose of truth was that, I wasn't a great leader. I was still learning how to be a leader, and so. What do you find to be that fine line or balance of maybe helping franchisees to realize maybe it's not their employees and it's them? How do they know if it's them and not their team?
Okay, so you just put your finger on a huge thing in franchising. When a franchisor vets a franchisee, they're obviously, looking at their finances and a few other things. But the experience of managing employees is not necessarily one of them. And the experience of managing hourly employees isn't one of them. A lot of people come into franchising exiting the corporate world. They've been in an environment with those on salary, those who are working full time. Maybe they've led large teams of those kinds of people. Then they get into franchising and they're building teams who might be getting, you know, minimum wage or just a little bit above that. Maybe it's a different age group. All the things that are different between salary workers and hourly workers, and I really get into that in the book. And then they're in shock because all those tactics that worked in that white collar environment aren't working with teenagers, people in their 20s, people who are, you know, their shifts are constantly changing. And so you'd think when a franchise says, we're going to teach you everything you need to know to run a successful business. Well, there's one thing they don't, and that is how to manage hourly workers. And so you might have someone with no experience in management, suddenly they're the boss. They have to build a team. But number one, a lot of franchisors, they themselves don't know how to really manage them, right? They're experts in pest control, in senior in-home care, in cheeseburgers, frozen yogurt. But the actual managing of people may not be their expertise. That's number one. But the second issue, which I know that you're well aware of, is lawyers have scared franchisors away from getting into anything HR related for fear of being labeled joint employers, right? So franchisors will teach franchisees everything about marketing, you know, maybe even get into like, you know, bookkeeping and certainly the system. But when it comes to managing employees, they either don't know or they're too scared to get into it. So I think that's a reason. That's one reason why it is a huge problem. Well, as we know, that might be about to change, and hopefully, you know, that won't be the case. But if franchisors are going to be considered joint employers with all that added liability and responsibility, they're going to then have to protect themselves, are going to have to get more involved in how employees are managed and creating a better manager experience. But I think you're right. It's not just the employees, it's franchisees and their managers. And perhaps they don't know as much as they think they know, or they really just don't have the skill set. The average person in a management position goes 10 years managing people before they ever get any formal management training. So think about the damage that they can do in that time. And so I think that's a huge problem in franchising and a lot of industries.
Yeah, I can see that. And to the joint employer thing, it's interesting because I remember the first year or so of being a franchisee and wanting to try to get my manager on some of the conference calls that the franchisor did, and they wouldn't allow it. They were like, no, you can't have any managers. And I don't know that they did a great job explaining why that was the case. And sometimes that happens with franchisors. Like, okay, I may agree with the decision if I learned why or the reason why you were kind of making that decision. But so that makes things kind of tricky, though, with franchisees, doesn't it? Because you have some of these folks who have never run a business before. Maybe they've never even managed, even salaried people before. And so now they're going and buying this business going, okay, I'm getting this proven blueprint framework. But then franchisors are going, hey, we don't want to get sued or in trouble, so we can't give you any advice in regards to how to really manage your employees or your team.
Right. And they might give them tools, right? Like especially a lot of the larger, you know, retail and QSR systems, you know, they have like online tools for, you know, for recruiting, and people can go online and apply for a job through this like international system, you know, and, you know, they're vetting employees, that kind of thing. But at some point, those employees have to be met and interviewed and onboarded and trained and then coached for performance. And that has to happen at the unit level, right? With the franchisor and or their managers. And typically the large franchise brands, well, small franchise, particularly the franchisors, just don't get involved in that in order to protect themselves. And look, I also understand when I was a franchisee, I don't want to be micromanaged. I don't want to be considered a middle manager. I want to manage my employees the way I want to manage them. But what if I don't know how? And what if I don't know that I don't know how? I'm going to manage my employees the way I was managed because that's the only exposure to management I ever got. And if I had bad managers and previous life experiences, well, I'm going to pass that down to my employees and it's not going to be as good as it could be.
What's up, guys? Real quick, I wouldn't be honest if I said this podcast doesn't take a lot of time, effort, and money to put on every week. I do this podcast because I truly want to help you. So if you haven't rated or reviewed the podcast yet, I would be incredibly grateful if you could take less than 30 seconds and do so. Your review will not just help us grow the podcast, but also get this in front of more people who need to hear it. Thanks and enjoy the show.
Yeah, that's a solid point. I'm a huge believer in modeling. Tony Robbins talks about it, which is you find someone who's doing something in a way that seems to be effective or working. You find the most effective strategy, and then essentially you copy it or you make it your own, call it modeling, right? So what are you seeing are some of the characteristics of the owners who create high-performing teams?
So it's a great question, and I dove deep into that in this book. Just like The Wealthy Franchisee, I went out and I met all these top franchisees from a variety of brands, and I spent time with them, and I interviewed them, and profiled all of them, and I really looked for the common denominator among them, and I get into that in that book. And I do the same thing in this book. I mean, I really spent a lot of time getting to know these people. What's interesting is they sounded, a number of them are franchisees, but some of them are, you know, running factories or some, you know, the independent dry cleaner. It's not really just a franchise book by any means, but they all sound like wealthy franchisees. They understand the human side and they make it a priority. So they understand the difference between being nice to employees and building culture. Because those are two totally separate things. Just because you're nice to someone and you buy them pizza, I'm so tired of hearing about pizza and gift cards and celebrating birthdays. Those things are nice, but that's not what builds culture, right? The military doesn't create that unit cohesion because the drill sergeant buys everyone pizza. Like, that's not what creates culture. So they're really big at creating culture. They're also
what does create culture, Scott?
Okay, how long is this podcast going to be? That's a huge, huge thing. I have a whole section of the book about that, but I'll share some really big ideas for that. Think about what is culture. By the way, any group of two or more people has a culture, whether they realize it or not. Culture isn't a nice relationship. Culture is a combination of two things. It's the shared beliefs among people, and then it's the behaviors that they share. It's their social interaction. It's the social norms of relationships. Okay. So if every time I see you, you and I are high-fiving, and the first thing we do is we share a story, and if you sneeze and I say bless you, and we just have our ways of doing things, those are our rituals. That's our culture. If every time we see each other, we give each other, you know, dirty looks, you know, that kind of thing, or we insult each other, that is also part of our culture, right? If we're neighbors and every 4th of July, we go outside and we barbecue together, that's kind of part of it. It's like, what are the social norms? How do we greet each other? How do we resolve conflict? Right? What are we working towards? Okay. So, you know, for example, I used to be a bellman at a hotel. I was one of the original bellmen. They taught us how to be bellmen, but they didn't do anything to facilitate healthy relationships. So the culture just became what it became, which was we bellmen, we compete to see who gets to greet that Mercedes pulling up first. That's probably going to be a big tipper, right? Mm. We were very tip focused instead of very guest focused. Because that's just, you know, what it became. So what's normal in some environments is for there to be cliques. In other environments, it's absolute love and cohesion. So great cultures, the best are built by design, but most are built by default. So to answer your question, so first of all, so what culture is the social norms of a group? So what all these great environments do is they're very deliberate when they onboard employees. First, they hire for culture, for cultural match. They teach them their values, their mission, and not with grand abstract concepts. We're here to change the world. Like if you say that to someone who's working at a frozen yogurt shop, there's going to be a disconnect. It's too big. It's too abstract. It doesn't connect their work they're doing. So they bring culture down to earth. They discuss what it means. They say, hey, when you come to our work environment, this is how we behave. This is what we do to take care of each other. So they discuss it, and then they have rituals that reinforce it. And it might be a pre-shift meeting, right? It might be all kinds of little things that this is our way of doing things that you're not going to get over there. So I get into it with the book about, you know, even small things like you don't issue uniforms, you give them swag. Take that same uniform, fold it up nice, put it in a gift bag, and make a little ceremony out of presenting it to a new employee, right? There's all kinds of little things you can do that say, wow, this place feels different than that other place down the street that's offering another dollar per hour more. So it's being very deliberate about having a common set of beliefs and then rituals that reinforce those beliefs. So I don't know if that answers, you know, I have so much more to say, but we don't have enough time here.
Yeah. No, that's really good. And like just that simple idea around the uniform, right? It's something that can appear to be so obvious or so small, but they really stack up and it really makes the difference. And I remember I used to say to our team, and I think, you know, actually one thing that I like to do now in our current business where all of our team is virtual, but I don't like to use the word employees. I just like to use the word team. And I think it just, you know, makes a difference, maybe a subtle shift, but anyways, just something that I personally like to do. But, you know, I used to say, hey, we have juice bars, right? So people, they want to feel better when they come into the store. That's typically why they're coming in. They want to experience happiness, right? And which is what we're offering. So it is important to smile and welcome and say hello, you know, when people come in, because it's about creating and fostering that environment of them feeling better for that brief moment, you know, that they're in our store. And so I think that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned you're referring to something else there that for me, it's huge. It's huge in the book. And I'm writing a lot of articles right now that are going to various places in support of promoting a book. And most of them, I'm hitting hard on this idea that, you know, there's what people want, there's what people need. When we look at needs, I believe that customers and employees have both hard needs and soft needs. So we look at employees or team members, whatever you want to call them, associates or anything like that. They have the hard needs, right? And primarily that's money, but it might be other benefits, that kind of thing. And most employers just focus on the employee's hard needs, just like most employees focus on hard skills more than they do soft skills. So, you know, at the end of the pandemic, when people were desperate for employees, they just threw more money at the problem, right? Well, let's try to meet their hard needs even more. But employees also have what I call soft needs, emotional needs, ways they want to feel at work. Just like customers, you know, don't just want a product or service. They want to feel something, whether they realize it or not. They want to feel better when they leave after they've had a transaction with you. Well, so do employees. Employees want to be a place that meets their hard needs, but also meets their soft needs, where it's going. And that means paying attention to what are the soft needs of your team members. And it's things like wanting to feel like they're part of something, recognition, flexibility. Get to know your employees and what are those emotional needs? And so if you, all things being equal, people are going to go where their hard needs are being met. So I tell employers, don't be equal, you know, pay fairly. I think it's important. But when it comes to soft needs, do better than everyone else. And then you're going to be more attractive to bring in more employees. And they're more likely to stay rather than leave for an extra dollar per hour, because they don't want to leave this place that feels so healthy, that, you know, boosts their self-esteem, where they have a sense of belonging, where they feel like at the end of the shift that they've grown, they developed, and they've contributed to something important. So just like customers come back because of the way we make them feel, employees stay and tell their friends because of how we make them feel. And the opposite is also true. They leave and tell others because of how we make them feel. And so a big part of my book is understanding the importance of speaking to people's soft needs. Even when you're trying to recruit them in your help wanted posts, speak to their emotional desires rather than just saying you get paid X number of dollars and you get these benefits.
Yeah. So what would be an example of speaking to those emotional desires?
So in a help wanted posts, right? One thing I do a lot in my speeches, and I do this, in my book, is I read two different help wanted posts from two different restaurants looking for a dishwasher. And they couldn't be more different. They both want the same thing. They're sort of offering the same thing in terms of hard needs. But one just focuses on the hard needs. Here are the hours. Here's what you have to do. You must show up at these times. You must be able to work these hours. It just sort of, you know, here's what you're going to do. It just speaks to the hard needs, but it's kind of harsh. And they might be thinking, well, we want to weed out people who aren't going to meet these requirements and they need to know what it's going to be like. But they're probably weeding out a lot of people who'd be great, but who are like, wow, this place sounds really harsh. So then I read this second ad from another restaurant that gets it. And it talks about why we're here and how your job is to delight all these other people. And we want you to be yourself. We're going to celebrate you because you're going to have a better experience and guests can feel that. Like, it really uses that kind of language. It gets into the nuts and bolts of the job, of the hard skills that are needed and the hard needs that are met. But it spends a lot more time on the soft needs. And it's addressing people human to human. And it just seems like a fantastic place to work. And they couldn't be more different, right? But you would never run an ad for customers that say, must have working credit card. Like, you don't speak that way. You want to get them excited, right? Well, these days, I believe it's harder to find good employees than it is to find new customers. And so we need to do the same thing. We need to use that kind of language, especially with younger generations who are much more emotionally tuned in than previous generations, both for better and for worse. But they wear their emotions on their sleeve. It drives their decisions more. So we need to not judge that. Instead, we need to tap into it and use that to influence them.
Thanks for being a supporter of this podcast. The only way this podcast grows is from word of mouth. So if you've gotten one nugget or learning lesson from any episode that we've done, share this with someone who pops in your head that you think will benefit. Imagine the impact you can have by helping them learn something that can build their business. People will associate the value they got from the information from you, the person who shared it with them, all because you shared it with them. I appreciate you and your support. Let's get back to the episode.
Yeah, that's interesting. And one of the things that I tell to some of our folks that work with us is to, whoever feels comfortable doing this, but what I've started to learn is to create a polarizing message, and you can attract the right people. Like, as an example, if you kind of want to create a winning culture, right, in your business, where you want competitive, driven people, like maybe athletes, like you can speak to that, right? You can say, hey, we have a competitive and winning culture here. So if you're someone who's been a prior athlete and you want to be on a winning team and you're tired of working with people that you consider to be lazy, you don't want to pick up their slack. You want a team that everyone's focused on, high performance or whatever it is. And it's a polarizing message. You will probably offend some people who read that post, but you'll probably attract the right people. And I think sometimes people are either scared to do that, employers, specifically smaller businesses that have a little bit more flexibility in kind of what they can post or say. But I think it's an interesting opportunity to really attract your tribe, right? Because isn't that important to attract your tribe in creating that culture?
Yeah. And that word itself, by the way, is polarizing. But I know exactly what you mean. And another metaphor I like to think of is fishing, right? You can cast a wide net and pull in any fish you want. But if you're going for a specific kind of fish, well, then you need to use specific kind of bait and specific kinds of tools, that kind of thing. And as an employer, you should be narrowing your search to the kind of people you want. Like, if you need and want people who are competitive and want to be part of a team and they've kind of have that drive, right, they're going to be the best fit for your culture. So I think I haven't really thought about it that way of using polarizing language that really excites the kind of people you want and is a little off-putting to the kind of people you don't. It is a weeding out process. Now, that's in an ideal world, but when you're strapped for employees and you just need someone with a heartbeat, well, then maybe you don't want to use such polarizing language, right? Like, in an ideal world, it's like, yes, we hire for culture. Never bring anyone who's not a perfect fit. Well, for me, another part of my culture is providing great customer service. And I can't do that if I don't have any employees because I've been too selective. So there's a little bit of a balance that's there. But generally speaking, I love that idea. And I love describing it that way as polarizing. I wish I knew that term when I wrote the book. I would have stolen it from you.
All good, man. Version two. That brings a good point, because I remember there being many times, and particularly when COVID hit, where we just needed bodies, and we just needed bodies to be able to work the store, and just trying to find people overall was very difficult. So how can owners navigate that in stopping the shift show, right? When maybe they just need people. How do you make the best of that? How do you turn lemons into lemonade in that situation? What's maybe one kind of specific technique or tool or just something that you see some of the better owners do in those instances?
Sure. Well, you know, I did a TED talk, TEDx talk a few years ago, or whatever. And, you know, my main idea was you get thrown a lemon, eat the lemon, sort of lean into it and try to find the benefits from that rather than just trying to flip it. So that kind of metaphor works for me. But, you know, when I wrote this book, I wrote it as a reaction to the fact that most leadership management books are highly theoretical, that they are either written by academics or consultants or by people who've led big white collar companies, but haven't necessarily spent a lot of time with this group. So I wanted to target to this group, but it's also important that it be like actually helpful, pragmatic, realistic, right? And not theoretical, you know, which is why I like to acknowledge the fact that sometimes you're not going to find people who are a perfect cultural fit or not ideal. And you need that warm body because the pizzas have got to get baked and pulled out of the oven and boxed and delivered. And we need people to do that. And so it's a bit of a balance. And so you start off just, you know, any port in a storm, as they say. And, you know, so maybe you get people who are not ideal, but then you up coach them. You teach them about culture. And then every day you do things to try to help convert them, to try to onboard them and try to lift them up. I mean, we should be doing this anyway. And you'd be surprised how many people, they start off as the wrong fit, but then you can get them there. I also think that we need to hire a lot more people than maybe we needed to previously. Because number one, retention is harder. But number two, because flexibility is such a huge priority for the generations that's coming into the workforce right now, that it's easier to provide that flexibility by having more employees who can cover each other's shifts. The other reason for having more employees is then if you need to start letting people go because they're such a bad fit, well, then you're covered. So you have a bit more of a choice. And so I like that idea of the polarizing messages, but how polarizing? It kind of depends on the times and how desperate you are for employees. So you do the best you can. And sometimes in order to provide the customer experience you want, you may have to settle a little bit with who you bring on, but then you manage them even better to see if you can get them to be closer to who you need them to be.
Yeah, such a good point. And, you know, one of the challenges that I found, Scott, being a, you know, very high D on a DISC profile type A individual was kind of that people component, the relationship component, the so focused on the task that, you know, the care wasn't coming through, right? And which I think is a lot of what you speak to. And so it's something that I have to think about on a daily basis of maybe just directing it. I like that phrase of just eat the lemon, right? Which is really interesting. And I'm thinking like, how may I have done that? Which is like, hey, I know you probably don't want to work here for a long period of time. You may not be here in 6 months or a year, but what I'd like to do is support you in being great at whatever you do next. And so I believe that starts with being great here because it's typically a pattern. Like how you do anything is how you do everything, that cheesy line, right? But typically if you show up as like not caring here, well, how are you going to show up in your dream job? And how, you know, how will that wind up affecting you? Now that didn't always work, that speech there. But, you know, I think it just shows an element where maybe where if someone would have checked out here, right, they're like, oh yeah, that is a good point. I appreciate that he acknowledges that I don't really want to be here or be here long term, but this can help me kind of become the person I want to be, you know, for the next thing, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of employers say that and they don't mean it. And, you know, they want people who are going to stay and make a career by staying at that hourly wage at that place, just being a cook for years and years and years. And, you know, even though there's not an opportunity to grow, if you do your job as a great manager, your employees will outgrow you. But that's okay because there's always going to be new people. Like, I think that's just the right way to live. And so what I advise people in the book is when you onboard people, find out what are their goals and what are their dreams. And then find a way to connect the work that they're doing here with what they'll be doing there. Like, what are the skills, right? What are the people skills, the hard skills, the soft skills that they're going to need? And then genuinely help them see that in their work and create those kinds of opportunities. Maybe give them a book to read. But let them see that you are coaching them, not just to thrive here, but you're coaching them to thrive where they're going to go. So if they see the connection, if they think like, wow, by working here at this place, I'm really growing and I'm really learning things and that's going to help me later. And my manager is even willing to talk to me about that. Like they're invested in the work I'm going to do there. That creates more loyalty. That creates more meaning, more purpose, right? Compared to just saying, well, here, you're going to learn to work hard. Well, what does that mean, right? It's like, no, we're going to really teach you how to be a great salesperson. We're going to teach you how to be an excellent collaborator and part of a team. And we're going to show you what culture is and how you can enhance it. We're going to show you how to provide exceptional customer experiences, which you're going to need later in life when you want to start your own business. So then you teach them these things, but you continuously relate what they're learning here to what they want to be doing there. And when they see that you actually see them as more than just your employee, but you see them as a human being who's got goals that are beyond your, they're more likely to stay longer. And so, but then you genuinely have to want to develop them, right? So I think that's super, super important.
Yeah. And what do you think are some of the red flags for owners that may not realize it's them and maybe not their team? Like if we were having a heart to heart and like, come on, man, you know, you may be missing the mark here. What are some signs where someone can be self-reflective and go, okay, I need to step up as a leader myself. It's not, I can't keep blaming it on my employees.
If you have one or two employees who are driving you crazy and who aren't performing, all right, you might have mishired them. You might have some people who are just not the right fit for your environment. But if you sort of feel that way about your whole team, the first place to find the solution is the mirror, because you've hired them, you created the culture or allowed the culture to become what it's come. You have tolerated this. I wrote an article about providing a better customer experience in retail settings. And I talked about training your counter people to like try to identify the soft needs of customers and sort of speak in that language. So you're not just, you know, giving them the product or service, but really elevating their emotions. And a couple of days later, this was a Nation's Restaurant News. Yeah. And I get this really angry message from this guy saying, you know, I run this fast food restaurant and I can barely get my employees to show up, let alone be, you know, armchair psychologists. Have you ever actually run a business? Why don't you get some real experience before you start writing articles? Okay. And yes, I've run my retail businesses, as you know, I've managed hourly workers and I struggled in the beginning, but when I changed myself, it changed them. And as you know, I've worked with all these other businesses and business leaders and people who are able to do what I was talking about in the article, that it is possible. So just because, you know, his employees weren't able to do this, it didn't mean it was possible. It meant he, in his experience, didn't create the environment where they could be that way. It never occurred to him that he might be the problem. So if other people are able to do it, and I'm here to tell you, and I write about it, they can and they do. Right, without paying any more than you do, in quick service restaurants, with people who are not very, you know, who have lesser skills, lesser education, and lesser pay, it's a minority, but it is possible. So you have to look in the mirror. And it's interesting, you described yourself as a D in the DISC profile. I'm also a D, leaning towards I, but and the problem with people like you and I is we're very results oriented, right? You know, get stuff done. And the problem is when you're just focusing on that, sometimes you can alienate people and step on their toes and sort of forget their humanity. I know this planning vacations with my wife. You know, I will bully her into saying, yes, here's where we're going. And it doesn't always work out. And one thing I found in doing the research for this book is a study was done where they looked at 100,000 managers and interviewed all their employees, a million employees, getting all this information about these managers. And so these managers, 100,000 of them, were ranked, you know, top profile all the way down to the least effective managers. So they isolated one group of managers who were described as very results oriented, but not people oriented. And of those managers, only 9% of that group were in the top 10% of all managers. Okay. So then they looked at the opposite group. Managers who employees described as not very results oriented, but really people oriented, right? Growing their employees, caring about culture. You know how they did? Worse. Only 8% of that group were in the top 10%. Turns out, like you were saying before, most employees, most players want to play for a winning coach. But when they looked at managers who were described both as people-oriented and results-oriented, 82% of that group were in the top 10% of all managers. So what that means is that those of us, if you own a business, if you're a manager, if you have, you know, employees, you really need to deliberately go back and forth. And you can't do it at the same time, because to be results-oriented, you're using your prefrontal cortex. To be people-oriented, you're using the middle brain. And there's this neurological seesaw. You can't really do both at the same time. So you really have to be deliberate about saying, okay, I know I'm a D in the DISC profile. I want to get stuff done. I need to stop for a second and really look at my people and think, what can I do to enhance the emotional experience of their work? Because that's going to help the numbers anyway, but it's also going to help them grow and create a better work environment.
Yeah. Wow. That's a pretty fascinating study.
Yeah. Like I said, with this book, I'm really trying to keep it real because I want to help people. And I don't want it to be people think it's just going to be some motivational book about, hey, you know, be nice to your employees, you know, we're all in the people business. Like, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Yeah, it's, it's interesting. We've recently started to integrate EOS. Are you familiar with EOS?
Sure.
And we've started it. And the structure of it all has been really cool and helpful. And, you know, really that segue into meetings and connecting, you know, just at a individual and personal level, it really makes a difference. I feel like that is where you know, the culture is built, and that laughing, sharing, you know, joking around, it's in those small moments, really. And they're easy to miss. I mean, sometimes it could just be 2 or 3 minutes that does create that people element.
Yeah. It's what happens at the water cooler in the old school, traditional, you know, white collar environment. Right. And I think what happens there is this, is that, you know, throughout the day, unless something changes, that you and I are just coworkers. So I see you in two dimensions. I don't see your humanity. So there's no connection. And if I don't connect with you, well, then I don't care as much about what's happening. But if there can be moments created where I see your humanity and you see mine, I don't just see you as a coworker, but I see you as a friend. I see your humanity. I see you as a father and a husband and long distance runner, and you know, all the things, you know, I really see you as a person. You feel seen. You can't help but then have a bit more of a bond. And those bonds make us want to be there. They make us want to do better, because now I'm just not working for myself. I'm working for those other human beings who need me, and I need them. And the problem with too many work environments and bad cultures is there's not enough of that, right? And younger workers, especially Generation Z, who are a bit more emotional, they've made it very clear that they're not going to stick around in a toxic work environment. Like, they value life balance way more than ambition or achieving goals, right? So something's really going to have some kind of psychological toll, feel very cold and healthy, they're gone. And they're going to be fine living with their parents, and, you know, because they've been taught to really kind of, you know, focus on life balance, which, you know, when you want to get stuff done, it can be frustrating, but it's kind of a good thing. Like, we older people love to, you know, we're so proud and all the suffering that we are willing to go through for some employer, right? That's like this work ethic. No pain, no gain. It's like, well, are you sure? Yeah, of course I believe in hard work, but I don't think it has to be as painful. If we could just be a little bit more human, it doesn't mean soft, it doesn't mean weak, and it certainly doesn't mean coddling or enabling our employees. But if we can operate with just a little bit more humanity, not only does it make it a much more pleasant place to work, it's a much more engaging and inspiring and ultimately profitable place to work. And that's what I saw with all of these really high performing managers and business owners who I included in my book. One of my criteria for all these people is they had to have operations that were financially thriving in their industries. So top franchisees, top manufacturers who are really getting results on top of the people stuff. And so there's a connection, and that human piece is important.
Mm. Yeah. Did you talk to Adam with Budget Blinds? I think he said you guys had connected at some point.
We did a while back, the very beginning, but for various reasons, I ended up focusing on other people, but he was awesome.
Yeah. Adam's great. And he had, in the corporate world, had, I think, oversaw a huge team and kind of had that experience coming in. And, you know, I think it's interesting to me sometimes seeing the overlap in the folks that do have the, at least the experience in managing coming in. So sometimes the folks that, you know, don't have any experience at all and they're coming in to the business for the first time have, you know, I guess a slight disadvantage. But I want to pivot to this point, which is, okay, so let's say that, you know, someone starts coaching up their team, you know, they start kind of doing the water cooler talk and doing some of the little things and starting to work on the culture, but they're finding that, you know, things aren't really changing. And what's that fine line, or what are you seeing is the moment when you realize you got to start cutting people loose and you may just have the wrong people?
Sure. So let's start off with like the practicality, real world piece of that, which is how desperate are you for employees, right? Like what do you have to settle for in order to make sure that your customers are okay? Like, I don't go out to restaurants too much anymore because I feel like in most instances, the guest experience is so poor. And I understand that maybe they're short-staffed, or maybe they're holding out to have the right people. I appreciate that. But if it means that it's going to be 20 minutes before someone even brings me a menu and the food takes a long time, well, then I don't want to be there. You know what I mean? I'd almost rather have mediocre service, you know, that than no service, that kind of thing. So there's that balance there, right? But if you're not quite as desperate for people and you can have some standards and you've really tried, and I have this whole coaching methodology that I explore in the book, 5 chapters on 30-second leadership, which is all about diagnosing employees for a given task, looking at their hard skills and soft skills separately, and then based on your diagnosis, determine what's the best way to coach them. So if you've really done this for employees, you've worked on culture, you've trained them properly, like really trained them properly, and done all these things, and they're still not getting there, well, then there's that diminishing returns. Then that time investment is time you're not putting into people who are a good match. And so I think that there comes a point where the best thing you can do for yourself, your business, your customers, the team, and for that team member is to promote them to customer, is to let them go. And with one exception, one guy I let go who I regret, I let go of him for the wrong reasons. All the other employees who I let go, my only regret with them is not doing it sooner. Because every time I did, the environment just got so much better. The work got better. And it made room for new people to come who were a much better match. So I believe, you know, hire slow and fire fast.
Yeah, interesting. All right, the last question I want to ask you is a little bit of a deeper one on this topic. But what do you think the role of the ego plays in owners or managers in stopping them from maybe unlocking that great leader that's within them? What do you think the role of the ego plays in that?
Yeah, the ego is there to destroy your business. The ego exists to separate the bad leaders from the good ones. Like for me, and this is a big thing I talked about in The Wealthy Franchisee, is, you know, why are you there? Are you there to, you know, build your ego, or are you there to build a business, right? If you want to make money, you got to make a difference. And no one cares that it's you. I used to work at another hotel before I was a bellman. I was one of my first jobs. I was a front desk clerk at a Best Western hotel. And the owner would come by and he'd introduce himself to people. And he'd always say, hi, I'm Frank and I'm a general manager and I'm part owner. He'd always say part owner. And I always wondered why he said that. Now, if his intent was to make the guest feel special because, wow, they're meeting the owner, well, then that's great. And then they know, okay, he's the person who we can go to if we have any concerns or questions. But as I got to know him, he wanted everybody to know that he was the big man on campus, right? And no one cares. They're there for their own experience. And so, you know, I really believe in the concept of servant leadership, that the best leaders lead by being of service to their staff. They're not subservient, but they exist to use their skills, their knowledge, their resources to build everyone else up. I say, you know, first of all, you want your customers and guests, they should be the star of the show, not you. Build them up. And the best way to build them up is by building up your team members. Let them feel great. Let them feel like the place is theirs. And you just kind of kick back. Your ego will not bring people. You're not going to get respect. You're not going to have people who are going to want to be with you. It's very off-putting. So you can serve better when you can not make it about you. So put your ego aside, be more of a servant, and then you're putting more value out there, and that's going to attract more money.
Man, I really love that. And one of the reasons why I asked that is because for a long time, and still every day, it's something that I'm working and growing on, is that was a challenge for me, wanting to take credit as opposed to giving the credit to the team, right? And their value and their contribution. And I think people really feel that, right? They it's interesting how you talked about intent, which can be so subtle, right? The line between saying the same exact thing, but the energy of the intention, like, man, that's pretty deep.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, but again, and so this has come up so many times in our conversation, is it involves reflection, it involves humility, it involves looking in the mirror and saying, am I really being the best leader I can be? Am I really being an asset to my operation, or am I a little bit of a liability? What is my operation? What are my team? What are my customers? What do they all need most from me? And it's probably not for me to talk about how awesome I am. It's just to be awesome in service of them. But again, it involves the humility. And this is something I noticed with all these great managers and leaders who I profile in this book, is none of them are like, we have a great team because I'm such a great manager. You know, a lot of them were very humble. And when I wrote The Wealthy Franchisee, I noticed the exact same thing. That there's confidence, but there's humility there as well. You know, I'm thinking of one person in particular, one gentleman, Sean Riley, from Maine. He runs a company, manages a bunch of hotels, mostly Hiltons and Marriotts. And this guy is just awesome. If there's anybody who has a right to be an ego with him, he was so humble. And like, even when I showed him in advance the profile I wrote about him, he had me rewrite a few things because he thought it made it too much about him and he wanted the focus to be on his team. But I know his team is that way because of the environment that he creates, but I tried to find that balance. That is an example of great leadership.
Wow. Incredible. So cool, man. Awesome. Well, this was super, super refreshing. And, you know, really, I haven't had a conversation like this in a while. So it really encourages me, and I feel like challenges me as you're saying these things. I'm kind of thinking about myself and I'm like, oh man, I got some work to do to be a better leader. So I'm looking forward to diving into your book. For the folks that want to read it or listen to it, how do they get their hands on it?
Well, I appreciate the question. I just happen to have a copy right here that I'll put up on the screen. And I wasn't even going to mention it, but since you asked, the book is called Stop the Shift Show, Turn Your Struggling Hourly Workers into a Top Performing Team. It'll come out on February 13th, but it's available now for pre-sale wherever books are sold, certainly on Amazon. There will be the book itself. There'll be an ebook as well as an audiobook. You can order it now and then you can get it February 13th or later. And I'm super excited to get it out there.
Awesome. Well, Scott, thanks so much for coming on, man. I really enjoyed it.
Always a pleasure.
Hey, before we go, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I put my heart and soul into providing you value through this podcast to help you build your empire. So please subscribe if you haven't already. And the biggest thank you could ever give me is to drop a review, because more reviews equal this podcast getting more listens, which means we can share this message with more people and hopefully positively inspire them like we have you. You can also share it with someone you care about that you believe may benefit from listening. Thank you. And until next time, go build your empire.